The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to our World Books Week podcast. Now, I call it a week because what with World Book Day on Thursday and World Book Night on Saturday, we might as well make a fiesta of it. And then, of course, there's the launch of our very own website devoted to children's books.
This is the new Children's Books Podcast from The Guardian. We'll be featuring top authors from the world of children and teen books, listening to them read and asking them your questions.
Not everyone is the same, has the same taste in books at all. It's like people are totally different from you, but they still know what you're talking about because they still love books.
It's a nice change to read reviews by actual children instead of adults.
And stay with us too to find out why we boarded a train from Liverpool to London with the novelist and screenwriter Frank Cottrell Boyce.
Enjoy your journey on the story train and happy reading. But most importantly, we have a big group of young readers from Merseyside who will get to hear Frank reading from his book, The Unforgotten Coat, for the first time ever, right here on this train.
But this week has had its serious side too, not least the terrible events in Libya, which has been living under the dictatorship of Colonel Gaddafi for more than 40 years. One man who's more aware of it than most is the Libyan novelist Hisham Mattar. His father was abducted by the Gaddafi regime more than 20 years ago, and his second novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, uses elements of his own story. His narrator, Nouri, also lost his father to government kidnappers. Mattar came into the Guardian studios earlier this week to talk to Richard Lee. He began with a short reading from the novel, which picks up Nouri's story just after he first discovers that his father has been taken.
On the train to Geneva, we hardly spoke. I looked out onto the silver day. A slim road appeared down below, a black snake vanishing in and out of the thick growth. Houses on the passing hills, smoke seeping through the chimneys. How could I have not expected it? I did expect it. Did I not know that he had powerful enemies, that he was often followed? Why else was he so careful, so secretive? What would they be doing to him? Would I ever see him look at me again? All that I did not know about my father, his private life, his thoughts, why he was kidnapped and by whom, what he had actually done to provoke such actions, where he was at this moment, whether he could be counted amongst the living or the dead, was like a mask that suffocated me. I felt guilty, too, as I continue to feel, today, at having lost him, at not knowing how to find him or take his place. Every day I let my father down. I could no longer bear the presence of the woman who now sat beside me, hiding her eyes behind dark glasses, the tip of her nose glistening red. I could not understand why father had married her. I held my palm out, and she handed me the article again.
Anatomy of a Disappearance is clearly not a work of autobiography, but the central fact of your narrator's existence is father's kidnapping by government agents. Also applies to you as well after your father's disappearance in 1990. What are the dangers and opportunities for a writer of fiction in making such parallels between your characters and your own life?
I don't know about all the dangers, but one of the things that I found difficult was that it was a difficult place to inhabit for too long a time, psychologically, emotionally difficult to sustain. You know, when I'm writing about something that is difficult or something that eventually later on when I read moves me or I find very painful, the act of writing it doesn't feel that way. The act of writing it feels almost joyful when it's working, when it's happening, when I hit the right pitch or I feel I came close to what it is I was after. Or when the text runs ahead of you and you've, So that is a very different experience. But then, of course, writing a book is not just writing. It involves a lot of reading and rereading and rewriting. And that sort of space sometimes can be difficult. But that's the only sort of difficulty or danger that I can think of. What I'm interested in here is I'm not interested in the facts, obviously, as you said. I'm not interested in writing the facts of something that I have experienced. But I'm interested in exploring the existential state of losing somebody in this very ambiguous way. And the opportunities are that it can at times feel like resistance against the act, you know, resistance against the injustice in a way, that if you can sing about something that is very difficult, you know, because making somebody disappear is a violent act of silence, you know. Mm. So if you can not only speak, you know, there are different levels of resistance. There's a level as a citizen where you speak about the act and you detail it and you campaign and you write letters and you reveal the details of the crime. But then there's another much more interesting, in my view, level of resistance where you are being able to sing about this subject in a way and make something of it that is not restricted to the circumstances of that event, but something that goes beyond. So,
if you could take this appalling act and turn it into something that is in some way beautiful or good.
I think of it in the same way as somebody writing a poem in a prison cell. There's something about that act that is significant about being a human being.
There's a certain raw power for someone who knows the bare bones of the facts of your life in reading a sentence like, "Will I ever see him again?" Or the narrator saying that what he doesn't know about his father is like a mask that suffocates him.
Well, one of the ways to be able to write about the subject is to invent other circumstances and other characters. So for me, it would be at this moment in my life extremely difficult, unimaginable for me to write directly about losing my father. So I create a father that is deliberately very different from my father. But then I can use some of the power of the experience itself towards the imagination. You know, and so sentences like those, on some level, I share some of this, the knowledge of that condition, but they still, in my mind, belong very much to the narrator and protagonist Nuri El Elfi.
There's something Orhan Pamuk said. This is at the very bones of what the novel is about. That just as the writer says, "I made all this up," he still wants you to believe in it.
Absolutely. That you know, the event of writing, the event itself has to be authentic. If you have a skill to write a compelling narrative, a compelling drama, or a compelling scene, or a novel, or a chapter, or a sentence, then you can choose to use that in order to trick someone into believing something that you believe it sincerely. Mm. And one of the ways that you trick them is that you are actually tricking yourself. You're imagining the loss or imagining something that has happened and putting yourself in that. But that process of tricking yourself itself has to be authentic, you know, in order to try to get close, because otherwise you're then dealing with, otherwise it's sort of ingredients, you know, writing through ingredients. Oh, here I need something, here it's got to be something. And you can read that sort of writing, and some of it is very enjoyable to read, but it always remains at a level, there's a slight distance, you know. And I think what's actually interesting is that everything that happens to us, in my view, everything that happens to me, everything I see, all of the elements in my life, exist on one level, in a personal level, that is very private to me. It depends how I feel about them and so on, but it's a private kind of terrain. But then as an artist or a writer, for me, they exist purely for the service of the imagination. That, I suppose, is what I meant by resistance, is that resistance in the sense that the imagination, even in these very harsh realities, that the imagination continues to be fertile and continues to work.
Mm. Yeah. What's it like for you when the world outside shifts underneath your fiction, as it has done over the recent weeks?
I don't think I've ever thought of it in direct relation to my work. I think of it in direct relation to me as a citizen. so many things. I feel fearful and mournful for the people that have died and fearful for the ones that are alive. And I feel hopeful also for the future. And I feel like I have, and this I've spoken with several Libyans who felt something similar. I feel like I've come out of a cloud of some sort that I've been in all of my life. You know, I was conceived the year of the revolution. So I've been, all my life has been lived under this dictatorship. And I've never experienced life outside of it. And now I sort of sense that possibility. And it feels very different. I feel more able. And I feel also, I feel deeply moved. You know, this project, the dictatorship's project over the last, you know, almost half a century has been an incredibly comprehensive, violent, active project. It's never been passive about its people or about its the people's institutions or whatever. So after 41 years of doing that, and the people are still there, they're still alive, they're still yearning, keeping in mind that, you know, almost 80% of the Libyan population have been born like me after the revolution. And they still want these basic things. They want dignity, they want freedom, they want justice. Everybody keeps talking about freedom, particularly after 9/11, but actually the truth is that what people, I think, yearn for more than freedom is justice. It rejuvenates and confirms my faith in humanity, and you know, because it is very difficult to sustain that faith throughout 42 years of people telling on other people, people arresting, you know, friends and members of their family, and being pushed under this incredible pressure of the dictatorship.
But having said that, there's an enormous thirst at times like this when the world seems to shift. There's an enormous thirst for people to hear from novelists, for novelists to respond to these events. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think because novelists are interested in, ultimately, or at least I speak just for myself, I'm ultimately interested in how people live and what it means to live and how to live. And because I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, then that might allow me to say something useful about my own society. But I am slightly, you know, to be completely honest, I am slightly resistant to the romantic view. I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but there is this romantic view that is very potent and powerful in Arabic societies, and I think in the West too, that the writer somehow is a spokesperson for the people and so on. I feel very useless, you know, as a novelist during a revolution. I feel incredibly useless. I don't think I'm being nearly as useful as a baker in Benghazi right now, you know, or a doctor or a nurse. If we look at the Arabic novel has been under a great deal of stress because of the political situation. So you have, you know, censorship and oppression and imprisonment and torture really don't help literature. You know, they don't. You know, so, I mean, somebody.
There's this romantic idea that that kind of pressure produces some sort of flowering.
But I don't think it does. You know, I really don't think it does. I think the evidence shows that it produces, you know, coded literature that you have to really know. You have to be given a book in order to decode it, or then it escapes into something very abstract and romantic. I think that's why the mid-1900s, and late 1900s, a lot of Arabic novelists were very much attracted to French surrealism, and some of that has had some positive effect. But by and large, I think it's affected the Arabic novel in a negative way.
You learned only last year that after 20 years, your father may still be alive, and earlier this year, your uncle and two cousins were released themselves after long imprisonments. It's a kind of awful question, but do you fear for the disappearance of your fiction, of that ability to sing, if the miracle was to happen and you were to see your father again?
No, I don't. And also, I would give up everything for my father to return, including my own work. I mean, I would surrender dearer things, I would surrender my life for him, but You know, I don't take it for granted that I will always write. I know that I am going to write another book because I've been thinking about another book and I've started writing notes. So I know that I'm going to write another book. But I never took it for granted that I will always be writing books. You know, I would like it because I really enjoy writing. I am not one of those writers that begrudges it or, you know, I enjoy it. Of course, sometimes it's difficult, frustrating, but it's a privilege. I mean, it's an incredibly wonderful job. And I'd like to be able to do it forever and to do it to continue doing it. But, you know, maybe that will stop and something else will come up. You know, maybe I'll be a school teacher or a sculptor or a baker. Yes, you know, I worked as a stonemason for some time and there's something incredibly rewarding about physical work, I find. It's easy to romanticize it, but I did enjoy that feeling of being physically tired at the end of a day and seeing something that I see the result of my own work physically manifest. Because with writing, a lot of the times you spend weeks and then it all, you know, gets thrown away. Yeah.
On now to World Book Day and Night. World Book Day on Thursday was all about encouraging kids to read by, among other things, offering them a series of £1 books and tokens to buy them with. World Book Night is about giving books away for free, a million of them to be precise, at 48 per person. The curtain rises tonight, Friday, with a rally in Trafalgar Square. All sorts of celebrities will be there, including Margaret Atwood, Nick Cave, Alan Bennett, and our very own Lindsay Irving.
Well, it's billed as the single biggest books event ever held in this country. And you can imagine they are expecting 10,000 people, which is rather bigger than the last reading one went to at one's local bookshop.
We asked our listeners to phone and write in with the books they would like to give away or were particularly pleased to have received. Here are some of the messages recorded on Audioboo.
From past experience, I would say that some of the best gifts that I've been given have been books. But these have been from people who know me and know me well, so they know the sort of things that I would quite happily read. Giving gifts is a different aspect, though. Personally, I tend to shy away from giving books just because I'm always scared that I'm going to give someone something that they really wouldn't like or really wouldn't want.
I live in Canada, but my siblings have moved on to the States. My favorite books to send are Canadian bestsellers, things that my siblings may not have heard of because they're just not advertised over there. I'm thinking of Carol Shields or Miriam Toews. I also like to give books that remind us of our roots, which are French-Canadian, reminds us of our upbringing in Montreal. One that particularly comes to mind are graphic novels, basically comic books for adults. I'm very much a fan of the Paul series, Paul in Quebec, Paul Moves Out. The drawings, the language is like us growing up. Books makes excellent gifts.
Now, a couple of the messages suffered from bad phone lines, but it's the thought that counts. Seema Thabani told us that she especially likes to give children books to help their development. Usually it's storybooks, but she tries to find volumes that help shy children to come out of themselves. Prashanza T, on the other hand, hi again Prashanza, has never been given a book yet that she really wants to read, though she's a self-confessed bibliophile. As a result, she tends to give book tokens. She makes the important point that the inscription you write in a book can be as important as the book itself. On the message thread, Carpenter20M said, I think Joyce's Ulysses and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings are the most precious presents I've ever received.
Really, Ruby wrote, in the age of austerity, I'm giving literary postcards instead. Recently came across some really great poetry ones from an organisation called the Poetry Translation Centre.
Thanks, Ruby. I've just checked those out and they are indeed great. I'll be getting some of those. We also heard from a young man up in the English Midlands, Luke Shaw, who is keenly taking part in this book giving along with his father, Patrick.
I saw an article on the BBC website describing World Book Night, saying that they were getting thousands of people to give away a million books. So naturally I was interested because I like reading, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to share a book I like with
people. To get some of your friends as interested in reading as you are, perhaps?
Yes, some of them are. I've been a bit naughty and handed a few out early to some of my friends.
So you picked up 20 books?
We picked up
48
each.
Patrick, you're giving away Carol Ann Duffy's... Is it The World's Wife?
Yes.
And Luke, what are you giving away?
Selected Poems by Seamus Heaney, 1966 to 87.
So tell us why you chose them. Why did you choose Seamus Heaney, Luke? Because I wouldn't have thought... Hey, how old are you?
13.
You're 13. I wouldn't have thought this is obvious reading for a 13-year-old.
Well, I think poetry is something interesting because it's a completely different format to a book. And I thought if we were trying to get people to read who wouldn't otherwise normally read, then maybe we could get some people interested in poetry. Because personally, I like poetry a lot, so I thought it would be nice.
Patrick,
and he writes it himself.
Is this a bit of parental influence has come to bear here?
No, in fact, we thought there was so much competition for the books that if we went for poetry, it would be a less popular choice. And also because you can dip into poetry. And we had the idea when we hand out the books, we could get people to read a piece of poetry before we hand the book over.
Oh, that's a lovely idea. So who are you giving them to?
We live in a small rural village called East Bridgeford in Nottinghamshire. And we have some redundant BT telephone boxes that have been converted into libraries where people can bring a book and swap a book. So we'll put some of the books in there. And we hope to hand out some at bus stops in public houses.
Oh, so you're going to go on a pub round then, the two of you, are you?
Yes, we're going to try and do that. We don't know what kind of reception we'll get.
Uh-huh.
And also church coffee mornings.
I think although there's almost 50, I think we'll give them away very quickly.
Do you read poetry generally?
I quite enjoy reading poetry quite occasionally. But yeah, I do like poetry.
Because one thing that always struck me is that often it's something that you have to read at school and people therefore it gets a bit of a bad name. Everybody likes to write it, but a lot of people don't actually ever read it.
We've never covered it at school, so I was surprised by that. But I've got things like Larkin and Ted Hughes and Seamus Heaney, Carol Ann Duffy, Hamble, Roger McGough, Baudelaire, Aragon.
Quite very broad taste, in fact. You're also going to be involved in our children's website. You're one of our 100 editorial team members. Will you be wanting to discuss poetry there as well?
Yeah, that should be a really interesting thing to do because it's easier to discuss than books because you can go into a lot more detail with such a short piece.
Luke and Patrick Shaw there. And Luke is one of the founder members of our new children's books website. On Saturday, Guardian Review is going to be publishing lots of ideas too. Margaret Atwood puts in an appearance there among our celebrity givers. Lindsay, tell us what she's chosen.
She's chosen The Gift by Lewis Hyde, which is a good choice for all sorts of reasons. That book explains the difference between the money economy and the gift economy. She writes that she keeps, in fact, 4 or 5 copies around the house at all times to give away. And the book itself apparently inspired Jamie Bing to set up the entire World Book Night event.
Oh, goodness me. So she's definitely the leading lady in this event, isn't she? Tell us about some other people.
Well, 45 writers in all have joined in. Going back to our poetry theme, A.S. Byatt suggests the complete poems of Emily Dickinson or the poems of Wallace Stevens or Keats's Letters. Margaret Drabble says her favourite present for her grandchildren was Dr. Seuss's The Sneetches. Which is topical as we've just been celebrating Dr. Seuss's 107th birthday on the Guardian Books website. Meanwhile, David Eggers suggests Half of a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And there's some intriguing selections by people like John Lanchester, who talks about writers' books and recommends some of the books that writers give each other.
Oh, my goodness. Lindsay, what are you going to be giving away? Have you got any ideas?
The book I always give away compulsively is Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which is the most fantastic novel about the black experience in America in the 20th century and also about the nature of freedom itself. And it's written with incredibly vibrant language. And everybody knows it's a classic in America, but people think they've read it over here because of the H.G. Wells novel, and they haven't, and they should have done.
Now, I've As I've said several times on this podcast already, I've already given away 4 copies of Edmond Duval's Hair with Amber Eyes. I'm now very much in need of one, so if anybody wants to give me one, it would be gratefully received. But Mary Hoffman in Guardian Review actually reminded me of Louis Sacher's Holes, which is an absolutely fabulous novel for children, which I have given to countless children over the years, and I would do so again were I to know any of the right ages. To all you listeners, please join in with your giveaways on the webpage for this podcast at guardian.co.uk/books. So what about those children meeting author Frank Cottrell Boyce in Liverpool? Helen Carter joined them all on Lime Street Station.
At Liverpool Lime Street Station in the heart of the city centre, it's around 10 a.m. on World Book Day, freezing cold March morning, it's foggy, it's about 0 degrees, and the station is really quite spectacular in terms of its architecture. It's wrought iron struts, it's like a large hangar type building with beautiful sandstone towards its foyer. It's been refurbished, it's probably been stone blasted, and it looks all very polished for Capital of Culture in 2008. The train is just pulling up in the background, the London Midland train. There's also a statue of Bessie Braddock, the formidable Liverpool MP, made of bronze at the foyer of the station, and a statue of Ken Dodd with his tickling stick raised in the air. It's a busy place. Morning rush hour has just ended. Commuters are running to catch trains still, or dashing from trains to work. You can see people walking past wheeling their trolleys. Award-winning author Frank Cottrell Boyce is visiting school children for the premiere of his new book.
So, and have you read this before, or is this the first?
This is my first time.
You saw it today. You got it today.
Yeah, train station. I'm not sure what that means, sir.
Well, you've got to read the story. Is it the pictures are part of the story? So it's not like a book with illustrations. It's a story about these pictures. So, and the pictures sort of change meaning. So think, Carl, who took the pictures, is on the train, and he's going to give you all a Polaroid camera today, and you're supposed to take photos today, and you're supposed to make up stories too.
Oh.
Yeah, it's going to be cool.
I love making up stories.
And you're going to.
On the story train and happy reading. Along with Frank, we have members of the Reader organisation and Carl Hunter and Claire Henney, beg your pardon, who took Polaroid photos to illustrate his book.
Hooray!
But most importantly, we have a big group of young readers from Merseyside who will get to hear Frank reading from his book, The Unforgotten Coat, for the first time ever, right here on this train.
Kevin's going to be the teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to read this bit. And I'm going to read the opening bit, and then I'm going to come back later and read a funny bit. The person speaking is a woman, a grown-up woman, and she's looking back at her school days, okay? Okay, you've all got the photograph? I hadn't seen this photograph since the day it was taken until now. Even so, I can tell you anything you want to know about it. The boy on the left is Shockey. The one on the right is Duncan. He used to come to school with biscuits in his pocket. He's married now, inexplicably. The girl on the left is Mimi Toulon, and the one on the right is me. At the moment this picture was taken, I was mostly wondering whether Mimi would take me back to hers after school. Mimi's mum let her play with makeup, which my mum definitely did not, even though I was mature and sophisticated. I was also thinking, oh my days, Shockey has just put his hand on my shoulder. Once, just before Christmas, I had managed to manipulate Shockey into being my partner in a classroom activity. This should have resulted in a moment of physical contact, because it was a trust game, but it turned out that Shockey was not to be trusted. And by the time this photograph was taken, he had completed an unbroken run of 237 days of totally failing to notice my existence. How do I remember my thoughts so clearly? Because they were the only two thoughts I had in the first 2 terms of Year 6. 1. Mimi, can I come back to yours? 2. Shockey, please notice me. Also, this photograph was taken in the summer, and doesn't everyone remember everything about their last summer in primary. The sports day, the leavers trip, the leavers photo, the endless discussions of which school you're going to next, the promise to stay friends forever even though you're going to different schools, everyone signing their names on everyone else's shirt, and all the time you had that feeling that day by day, inch by inch, a door was opening and sunshine was pouring in, and any day now you'd be allowed out through that door, laughing and yelling so loud that you would never hear when it closed behind you forever.
You can help us celebrate World Book Day and the launch of this great book and great project by picking up one of the 50,000 free copies of this book, which will be placed in the magazine racks throughout this journey. Can you please help yourself to a copy to read, and why not share it with the person you're travelling with and the person sitting next to you, or take your turn to read with your family and friends.
With Patrick Fisher, who's a young person's project worker on the extended school project with the Big Read.
And I work with young people in schools, so from year 7 right up to sixth form, and it's primarily reading with children who either still have literacy problems or they are comfortable reading but have no sort of inclination to do so and feel quite disengaged and apathetic about reading. And we meet once a week and read one-to-one or in groups. And during the school day, it's selected by teachers, but after school in each school, we have an open group that anyone can come to. And each group has at least 7 participants, and one of them has 20, all staying after school. And previously, these children had never read, some of them had never had books read to them. And all of a sudden, we're reading short stories and poetry and moving on to longer books together. And everyone's taking a part reading aloud, even if it's one line, and just really, really enthused about reading and sharing their thoughts without any pressure of achievement or attainment in a lesson. And so it's always lighthearted. That's the main thing, because having fun is the primary objective, but there's so many knock-on effects of like improving confidence and awareness and kindness and listening skills. And there are children who've never read before, never been read to, and within a matter of months are reading Keats and Yeats and Larkin. And although it's difficult, obviously, to start with, and when we first read the poem, there's nothing coming. When we stop and read it closely in a line at a time and think about how the words sound and how they make us feel, all of a sudden these children have got a vivid picture of, you know, a very complex poem that is relevant to them.
One thing I'm really proud of about the book is that it's set very specifically in a very specific, very recognisable place in Liverpool, but it could be anywhere. But it's full of details about their life. It's like, you know, that's cheek in her face and all that. But it's also about Mongolia, so it's got eagles and wolves and the steppe in it as well. So it thinks local and it acts global, which is a cool thing. You know, that's great. That's what stories do, isn't it? All the Grimm's fairy stories come from a really tiny place in the Black Forest, but we all embrace them. So,
but I mean, just watching the reaction of the young people then, I mean, they're mad. Were open. Young people aren't easily impressed, as we know, you know, but they were
but you know what, reading to people is always impressive. I don't care how fantastically ornate and detailed your video game is, there's nothing really to compare with being told a story. That's why people talk to each other, isn't it? You know, we tell each other stories, and there is something magical about being told a story, or being read to is a fantastic thing.
You know, in terms of the reaction to the, we're watching people, you know, Virgin train staff walking along, reading, getting excited about it.
Yeah.
You know, how has it felt today to see so many copies of your book?
Oh, today's been magical because I've been involved with the reader. I've met lots of these children before, so it just feels like a party today. It's really great, and I love the fact that they think they own me. You know, I love the fact that they shout, "Frankie, come here, and can you do this?" And that's really sweet.
Yeah, it's completely natural.
Yeah.
These children, they can't believe it. It's like a superstar, basically. Like, to have not only a book like that's set in Liverpool as well, so it's referencing where they're from. Some children today are saying, "He mentioned Speak in the book." They're so wide-eyed in every school, and the thought of being on a train, some of these children have never even left the suburb of Liverpool they live in, let alone the city, and they've never been on a train, and now they're travelling first class to London with an author who's written a book for them and reading it as a world premiere to them.
One last thing, my daughter, who's 11, is a huge fan of yours. Will you sign a book for her?
We'll be thrilled to.
Thank you.
Helen Carter there aboard the World Book Day Express. And that's it from us for this week. We've already heard what to look forward to in the Guardian Review. The Observer's new review, meanwhile, will be rounding up some of the weekend's festivities and will also review some of the books you might want to give away. They include Joyce Carol Oates' A Widow's Story and a new novel, The Illumination, by Kevin Brockmeyer. Raves for both of those, we gather. Tell us a little bit more, Lindsay.
We'll continue with our Twitter stream of the Bath Festival reading of the King James Bible. Lots of other celebrities lined up for the finale. So if you find yourself in the West Country over the weekend, do go along to St. Michael's Without Church in Bath and take pot luck. You may even be able to read a bit of it if you're so inclined.
And finally, if you aren't among the 50,000 readers who've already checked out our new children's books website, do go and take a look at it. It's on guardian.co.uk/children's books. That's all one word. There are reviews, quizzes and a chance to win your height in books. That's if you or yours are 17 or under. Adults are allowed on the site, but only by invitation.
And for anybody who's sensible enough to listen to this podcast immediately, it goes up on a Friday. There's still time, if you're in London, to get down to the curtain raiser event for World Book Night on Saturday, on Friday night at 6 in Trafalgar Square, where there's room for 10,000 book lovers to go and see celebrities including Nick Cave, Alan Bennett, and rather weirdly Graham Norton, talking about books and reading from some of their own and some of their favourites. Should be an extraordinary event.
And if you can't get there, read what Lindsay has to say about it. Once again, thanks very much for listening. From me, Lindsay, and our producer, Tim Mavey, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.